When I used to audition kids to get into the drama school in Chicago, I would travel around the country and I would audition high school seniors, junior college people, and I would see about 700 to 1,000 people a year for 75 seats in the freshman class. Very competitive auditions. I would never presume to judge talent because I don't know what talent is. You know, I mean, how do you, kids comes in for 5 minutes, how are you going to judge talent? I would never try to make a judgment based on talent. I certainly wouldn't try to make my judgment based on the accoutrement of the audition. You know, all of these kids have watched Fame and they come in with the leg warmers and the leotards and they're all, you know, they're all ready to go be stars. And they look the part more than they can act the part. What I would always base the judgment on is a thing that I called presence. And it's a term that gets thrown around a lot in terms of courtrooms and courtroom demeanor. What is presence? I worked out a definition for myself because I was making all of these judgments based on it. Presence is comfort in being where you are. Presence is comfort in being where you are. If you look like you belong there, and you can make people not worry about you doing what it is you do there, you have presence. A kid starts a monologue, starts his audition speech, looks like he or she belongs on stage. They look comfortable in the milieu. They look like they really want to communicate something. They've got presence. They've got a desire to communicate the idea. They look comfortable. My greatest example of presence is Walter Payton. I moved to Chicago around the time that Walter Payton's career in football was just starting to take off. I think he had been on the team 1 year before I moved there. So I got to see him like from his second year on. I had never heard of Walter Payton before I moved to Chicago, and I went to a Chicago Bears game. And I wasn't even a Bears fan at that point. You know, I just, well, I got someone had tickets. We went to the game. All of a sudden, this little brown round object gets tossed to a guy who's wearing number 34 on his chest. And he starts moving with the ball, and 60,000 people are on their feet screaming. And I said, "Oh, this guy knows what he's doing." And the more I watched him, the more apparent it became that Walter Payton was totally present on the football field. He was comfortable. He knew what he was doing. He was prepared. He was drilled. He was so confident that he could be inspirational. If the play broke down, he could say, "Okay, let's go the other way," you know, and he would just change it. He would improvise midstream. Totally present when you gave him the football in front of 60,000 people with 300-pound men waiting to hurt him. He had no fear. He was totally present and able to do what he needed to do. Watch the 10 o'clock news when Mr. Payton is on talking about how the Bears are doing. Mr. Payton is not present in front of a TV camera. His voice goes up, it cracks, he sweats. I mean, man is a clothes horse. He wears these incredible suits. I mean, we only wish we could afford them. And he'd sit there, you know, muscles bulging, and he would sweat and get nervous. And he could hardly talk in front of the camera because his sense of presence and comfort had nothing to do with the TV medium. It had to do with carrying a football or passing a football or kicking a football or running with a football or whatever you had did in the afternoon, he could handle no sweat, no problem. But you put him in front of that TV camera and you say, "Share with us an idea." And he had a total lack of presence. He was uncomfortable. You got nervous for him. He looked like he was about to make a mistake. So you would stand there and say, "Come on, Walter, it's okay. Come on." You know, you'd start rooting for him so that he wouldn't embarrass himself. And he knew it, and he stopped doing that after a while. He's much too savvy to put himself into a situation where he didn't feel present and feel that sense of presence working for him. I think that in a courtroom, you can sense a lawyer's sense of presence when he or she looks like they should be trying a case. when he or she looks comfortable doing what they're doing. It's a wonderful thing to watch when the person has a sense of presence about themselves. It's an awfully embarrassing thing to watch when the person is uncomfortable doing what they're doing. I really wanted to be an accountant, but I'm a lawyer, you know, and they start fumbling through their case and they say, come on, you know, get behind it. You've got to have a sense of presence because people will look at you in the courtroom. There's no way that you can not be looked at. You go into that little gate, it closes behind you. You're in a separate arena. And in that arena, you should be comfortable. You should have the feeling of, I belong here. You should have the feeling of, this is my turf. You should have the feeling of, watch me do my thing now. Right? When lawyers get in there and the gates close and it's like, oh my God, a trial. And they start getting nervous. They don't look like they have that sense of presence. They don't look like they have that sense of poise. And I think that that is the jury's first clue to the fact that, uh-oh, this is not going to be jury-centered. The jury never uses the term jury-centered, but they're going to say, uh-oh, we got to worry about this guy. We got to worry about this person. What are they going to do? Are they going to screw up? Occasionally, it works out that counsel is so inept that they get negative empathy from the jury. You know, it's like, come on, kid, you can get this piece of paper into evidence. Give it another try. You know, come on, you can lay that foundation if you just ask those three questions. You know, you get this sort of negative empathy for the person. I've seen that happen once or twice. One time it happened when a woman accidentally spilled a glass of water all over herself. She was so nervous in the first trial. She got up, boom, 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 just spilled this water, and she was standing there soaking wet. And the jury's heart just went out to her because this poor person was now not only slugging uphill, but she was embarrassed. And they went out of their way to let her know, it's okay, dear. And she just really was able to turn that negative thing into a very positive thing. After she spilled the water, she was fine. Too bad she had to wear this wet dress all day. But, you know, that at that moment, the negative empathy worked in her favor. I don't think you can rely on that. You know, what you need to do is to appear confident, to appear poised, and to have this sense of taking the jury through this strange land. Millard Farmer calls it the strange planet of a trial. On that planet, you know the language, you know the terrain, you know how to get through the procedure, and the jury will look to you for information. And you've got to give it to them. You've got to help them understand things. I've seen trials where one attorney will stand up and be spit and polish, procedure, 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 and the other attorney will be human, will be fallible, will have a sense of humor, will have a warmth. And then as the trial progresses, when something goes on, you can see the jury look to that person. Like, what does this mean? You know, about 3 days into trial, they're looking at that guy to see if it's okay for them to get involved in a certain way with what's going on. Is this funny? Should we laugh at this? You know. Is this, and they're checking it out with that guy. And I think you want to be that lawyer in the room. You want to be the one that gives them the way of understanding the pieces of information. Question me about this. I love this dialogue that we've had about the jury-centered stuff. The questions that come up were wonderful, you know, and good ones too. Yes. There's a wonderful book that has kind of rekindled my faith in juries a little bit. It's called Reconstructing Reality for the Courtroom. It's a little one of those 5x9 kind of layout books. And it deals primarily with criminal law and criminal cases. And it talks about a lot of the stuff of storytelling that I talked about. But in one chapter, it talks about how this criminal justice system that we have is so incredible because it brings people from diverse backgrounds with no knowledge of the law and puts them into a setting where they have to assimilate, organize, and assess information before they reach a decision. And very often they're reaching a decision in areas where they have no experience, no knowledge, and for some amazing reason, the structure of the trial allows that to happen. So while if I take a given jury, I can have a lot of negative things to say about your average dumb juror at 11th grade or 12th grade intelligence or less, 8th grade intelligence, and their inability to read and the television mentality in terms of attention spans and all of that. And while I might be able to beat up on a given jury on those issues, I think that I have to say that I have an incredible amount of faith in the way the system is structured to put those people, regardless, in an environment where the information is going to come in a certain way that allows them to organize it, that allows them to discuss it, that allows them to ask questions about it, allows them to get instruction about how to deal with it, and allows them to reach a judgment. I think that that's a pretty amazing process. So while I don't have a lot of faith in juries or individual jury members' ability to cognitively process information, I do have a lot of faith in the trial and the structure of the trial. And a well-tried case is really a demonstration of form and structure. The form of the trial, the content of the information can't be disassociated from the form in which it comes in. And the form and content thing all goes together to make the trial a pretty dynamic process. I have faith in that. And I think that you might take a look at this book if you're a little bit jaded about the jury process, you know, because we really do have an incredible system.
Who do you have?
Got me. It's a man and a woman. It's University of Seattle Press, I think. But the name is pretty unique. Reconstructing Reality for the Courtroom. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a judge in Ohio who's written a bunch of stuff on it. I can't think of his name at the moment. But he and I have corresponded about it. It's split right down the middle. Every group of lawyers that I've talked to, there's 50% of the folks who think that those talking head videos in long trials are dynamite because the people are riveted to them. And there's 50% of the lawyers who think that they're absolutely bull and that they have, you know, they're badly shot, they're badly lit. The quality of the production on the video is not very good. They're not compelling to look at. Why the heck are we using it? My personal feeling is I don't believe that they would have as much impact as everybody thinks they have. Yet, I've not been involved in a trial where one has been used. And attorneys who have been in trials say that the juries sit there absolutely riveted to the box listening to this thing. I guess maybe what you need to strategize about is how to diffuse the medium. You know, how to go after the coldness of the video, the detachment, I don't know. I mean, I think you've got to somehow distance the jury from it. We've got a couple of opinions here. Yes, sir.
Critically, have about now, or not going to be valid longer, but people who are doing it recognize that the talking head doesn't do very much, right? They're going to the whole production bit.
So we're getting the comment is we're getting more and more professional production on it, which makes it even more difficult. And I wonder if you can't do something, and a motion in limine, you know, before the trial to say, wait a minute, this is a produced video. And how is that fair? And that's not a real documentary sort of approach. Ma'am, you were going to add? Subpoena him and bring him in live. Yeah. I did have one case where I was called. It was an asbestos case. We got a lot of those going on up in Illinois now, where the insurance companies are, you know, being called upon to defend their decision to insure a school that used a certain kind of asbestos 25 years ago. And I got called in to a law firm, asked me if I would come in and read the deposition of the insurance man who sold the policy to the school 25 years ago. And I said, sure, you know, this is my rate. I'll be happy to do that. I'll come in and read the deposition. I got there and it was 25 volumes of three-ring binders. You know, I said, it would take me 14 hours to read this deposition. You want to put me on the stand at this rate to read that many? You know, why not send a video camera out to Arizona where this guy now lives and have them videotape a statement from him? Plus, the deposition was impossible to read, because it was that kind of very technical insurance terminology and half thoughts and jump. I didn't have the background to understand the scope of his answers, so I couldn't make the thought jumps that he was making. And I suggested that they videotape him. I don't know whether they did or not. I never heard from them again. But it seems to me that there are times when it would be helpful. I don't believe that they have any place in the courtroom. And you know, I'm sure that my fellow actors in the Screen Actors Guild, who make their livelihood out of videos, will, you know, shoot me for saying that. But I don't think it's that powerful. Just a second. Yes, sir.
On the last question that I have, about a year ago, I wrote an article that the traditional view in law schools is that the trial is a search for truth between two competent attorneys, and the jury will be able to determine. I call that a bunch of nonsense, that the attorneys are there. They won't get paid unless they win, unless they're on retainer. That, in fact, it is a very unequal type of situation where you have competent, incompetent. God knows that. A George Mail versus some guy like me, we would be just cut to ribbons. So the essence of trial is really the search for truth. I'm talking about civil cases. Let's leave aside criminal. Is it a search for truth, insofar as we can know that, in your estimation, in experience? Or is it just one of these contests where the most competent guy with all these little tricks that you've been telling us about, is that the kind of thing that is the result of this, that the jury is sympathetic, empathetic towards all these little things? I'm handing this piece of paper this way. Ah, that influences me. Or is it really the truth that we're after? What is it?
I have a real negative reaction to your assessment of my teaching you tricks. I really hope that what I'm talking about here is an integrated approach to a trial, and how every element of persuasion, from brainstorming the theme to how you handle the codicil to the will, becomes part and parcel of a whole package that you've been working on. And I don't think of it in terms of tricks. Now, in terms of a civil case, I think that in a certain sense, civil juries are really interested in justice, and they're interested in fairness. I don't know that people are comfortable with the word truth anymore in the latter part of the 20th century in America, because the truth has taken on so many different, you know, if Oliver North is telling the truth, then why is Poindexter not telling the truth? And, you know, I mean, this, if Nixon told the truth and Reagan told the truth and this, I mean, there's lots of truths that get slid around on people. So truth may be an abstraction that we're not real comfortable with anymore. But I do think people are interested in fairness. And I think that fairness is something that comes out very heavily in civil trials. I think that people are interested. I mean, you've been involved, I've been involved in civil litigations where the jury comes back in to have the instructions reread. That tells me that they want to do the right thing. And when the judge hits the one instruction that they were all haggling over, you can almost see them go, you know, and they got it and they're ready to go back. I really think they want to do the right thing. I don't think that the trial is a never-ending series of tricks and manipulations. I think that there's a story to be told, and it unfolds in a certain way, and your competence in telling that story may involve certain techniques that have to do with some of the gimmicks that I've been talking about. But I really I really do believe that the trial has much more integrity than just who's more skilled at manipulating the information kind of approach. I think that the juries really do want to do the right thing, and they want to be fair. I would advocate working fairness into your closing argument as much as possible in a civil case. You know, is it fair that this should happen? I mean, what's fair about this, ladies and gentlemen? And that word fair really helps them take an action that really doesn't imply hurting somebody else. Because if it's fair, then we can get behind it. You know, I think that they're interested in justice, too. God knows if we know that justice is just as abstract as truth. But I think juries want to feel like they did the right thing. And if you can show them how they can do the right thing, Spike Lee's movie notwithstanding, you know, if you can show them how to do the right thing, they're going to feel comfortable taking that action. And that's what I think your final argument is about, you know, showing them what action you want them to take. I hate to make the analogy between being a lawyer and being a salesman, but in this regard, the sense of going for the closure, closing the deal is the final argument where you tell them how you want them to act. This is what I would like you to do as a result of this. I would like you to come back and give my guy money. You know, and if you don't ask him for it, they may not do it. Just like in sales, if you don't, a lot of people have difficulty closing sales because they don't ask. They don't say, this is it. Let's close it. Here's the deal. You know, they just say, well, if you think that way, maybe we could try, and it goes on forever. But when you ask for the closure that you want, you usually get it. So I think that lawyers and salesmen, I believe that lawyers are maligned when they're compared with salesmen. But I think in the sense of knowing how to close, which is knowing how to ask for what you want, there is an analogy between sales and closing a case. You were going to add something, ma'am?
Thank you.
Why not?
Well,
yeah. I think you can pretty much ask him anything depending upon how you go about it. Sir? It's required that they be able to read and write? Uh-huh. The catch is at what level? Uh-huh. Sir?
You said civil trial, the court, they want to do what's fair. Is there corresponding concern in a criminal trial? Or are they trying to also do what's fair trial? Are they trying to do what's right? Or who are they trying to do with someone?
I think in a criminal trial, the jury wants to punish somebody. You know, I really think they do, because we live in a very, in a society where retribution is really the rule. And as unfortunate as that may seem, and to me, as unchristian as that may seem, they want to punish somebody. So you got to show them who they can punish. I think you've got to show them that they can punish the state, or you can show them that they can punish the police officer for making a bad arrest, or you can show them that while they may want to punish somebody, the person that they want to punish is headed for the border, you know, and they don't have to punish the person who's here. Sir? The comment, for those of you who couldn't hear it, is that it turns on the witness being truthful and then a good skilled lawyer using that to his advantage in propelling the trial. I suppose that's true. I mean, but there's other people who would say it isn't, you know, and it gets into a debate sort of thing. Well, we're at 4:15, and I certainly want to thank you for your attention. You've been unflagging, and thank you very much.
This concludes Persuasion in the Courtroom with Joe Guastafaro. Thank you for listening to this program from the Professional Education Group's audio tape series. PEG is pleased to offer many other exceptional seminars on audio and video tape. We are the exclusive source for the most current programs featuring speakers like Irving Younger, James McElhaney, Paul Lisnick, James Jeans, and Gerald Williams. We also publish the popular trial transcript series, Classics of the Courtroom. For more information and a complete listing of our tapes and publications, you may call us at 1-800-229-CLE1 or write to the Professional Education Group, 12401 Minnetonka Boulevard, Minnetonka, Minnesota, 55343.